the policies that they are pursuing are increasing the likelihood of terrorist operations, and they know it.
The United States is in there saying that we're a liberating power, while actually, if that's what we're in there to do, then we have a really, really big task ahead of us.
Bechtel is a champion at using the revolving door between the highest levels of the U.S. government and its own profit.
Now, a thief like Jalabi, who embezzled $300 million, I would not trust him with my pussycat.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, April 18th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Less than 10 days after the fall of Saddam Hussein, thousands of Iraqis marched in downtown Baghdad today to demand a rapid U.S. troop withdrawal, and a prominent opposition leader said he expects Americans to relinquish most government functions within weeks. The pressure surfaced as American forces destroyed a hidden ammunition stock north of Baghdad, and troops captured a leader of the old regime for the second time in as many days. The U.S. Agency for International Development announced yesterday that it's awarding a $680 million contract for the rebuilding of Iraq to Bechtel, an engineering firm with close ties to the Bush administration. The money will go towards the reconstruction of Iraq's electrical grid and water systems damaged by U.S.-led bombing, as well as a dozen years of economic sanctions. But the Bush administration's role in awarding the contract has drawn much criticism from some observers. Among them is Jim Vallette, Research Director of the Institute for Policy Studies, Sustainable Energy and Economy Network, and co-author of the recent report, Crude Vision, How Oil Interests Obscured U.S. Government Focus on Chemical Weapons Use by Saddam Hussein.
There's not much surprise, and that's kind of the tragedy of the current situation, is that what's going on in Iraq is the ultimate conflict of interest. And Bechtel is a champion at using the revolving door between the highest levels of the U.S. government and its own profit. Public officials like George Shultz rode that revolving door from the presidency of Bechtel into the White House as Reagan's Secretary of State, where he orchestrated a pipeline pitch by Donald Rumsfeld in 1983, a pipeline that would have been built by Bechtel that would have run from Iran, from Iraq to Jordan. So the revolving door between Republicans and Bechtel has been going on for decades, and especially in the last 20 years. What we're seeing now is a company that did extensive business with Saddam Hussein now being rewarded instead of punished, and is being rewarded because of its ties with these officials.
So Bechtel actually did business with Saddam Hussein. Can you elaborate just a bit on that?
Well, yes. Bechtel has been doing business with Saddam Hussein since the 1970s when it helped to build a petrochemical plant. It continued through the 1983 to 1985 period that's covered in our report, Crude Vision, which documents the efforts of the Reagan administration and Bechtel to convince Saddam Hussein to build a million-barrel-per-day pipeline from Iraq to Jordan. After that pipeline project was canceled by Saddam Hussein, saying that Bechtel was trying to charge too much, they moved on to other kinds of business. In 1988, after Chemical Ali gassed the Kurds, Bechtel signed a contract with Saddam Hussein and his government to build another petrochemical plant, a big one outside of Baghdad. And that construction was ongoing right up until Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990. Saddam and his police placed hundreds of Bechtel employees under house arrest, and Bechtel's been out of business in Iraq ever since. So what this contract does is give Bechtel a long-sought foothold back in Iraq. And it's just incredible to see how companies operate and how willing Washington is to do their bidding.
Well, let's look at what Washington actually did. I think it raises some considerable questions as to the role that President Bush played in moving the awarding of this contract along. According to this morning's Washington Post, President Bush signed an executive order authorizing U.S. aid, or the U.S. Agency for International Development, to, quote, indemnify some losses and damages associated with the project, including those arising out of or exposure to chemical, biological, radiological, or nuclear weapons or materials associated with the project, end quote. In layman's terms, what does that really mean? Is this a major sweetener for this deal?
Well, these companies can't really do business in places like Iraq without the financial backing of the U.S. government. We've seen that around the world, where companies enter into some of the most volatile and despotic regimes, places like in the Caspian, in Azerbaijan, countries that are ruled by former KGB men, to Colombia, to African countries. The U.S. government has extended billions of dollars in insurance and credit and loans, putting the burden of doing business with these regimes upon the U.S. taxpayer and not upon the corporations that stand to profit from it. So this is just a continuation of the extension of U.S. finances, military, and might for the benefit of corporations with little regard for the people on the ground in Iraq, and nor for people in the United States other than those who are lucky to be investors in Bechtel.
Well, it's being reported today, again in the Washington Post, that the bidding competition was limited to six U.S. companies, but I thought it had been reported that this was a no-bid process.
Well, it seemed to be a bid by invitation only, instead of an open bidding process. If they opened it up, then it, under World Trade Organization rules, would have to open it up to global bidding. So they put in some special rules, and that naturally filtered out all companies except for those that are very tight with these officials who go back and forth between the White House and Pentagon, State Department, and these companies.
Is it too cynical, Jim Follett, to conclude that the Bush administration is waging this war in part to line the pockets of corporate executives at Bechtel and Halliburton, and that liberating the Iraqi people, which is the administration's line, is simply a sort of sophisticated or maybe not so sophisticated, maybe a thinly veiled plot to control the Iraqi oil and get wealthier in the process? Is that way too cynical, or is there any kind of basis for such a conclusion?
Well, there's a whole lot of circumstantial evidence that points to business being the driving force behind U.S. foreign policy, and certainly not democracy. The U.S. government has had no trouble at all cozying up with some of the world's worst regimes, as long as those regimes are doing business with U.S. corporations. U.S. corporations have been shut out of Iraq since the invasion of Kuwait. In the meantime, we've seen French, Russian, Chinese, Indian government and business interests getting footholds in this world's second largest reserve of oil.
Which is why those countries actually were not in favor of invading Iraq in the UN Security Council, one might conclude.
It's certainly a factor, and it's certainly, I haven't seen very many pure actors when it comes to oil. And what we need to do globally is de-link oil from our economy and from our fulfilling basic human needs. What is going to be paying for these reconstruction contracts under the Bush-Cheney vision is the sale of oil. And if it's going to run at $48 billion per year, which is what the White House has projected, that's going to require the production of billions of tons of oil, which will release more carbon dioxide than is currently produced by any country in the world except for the biggest six economies of the world. In other words, this occupation, overhaul of Iraq, and the ultimate paying for this invasion occupation is going to produce enormous amounts of oil that will enhance climate change, entrench the global fossil fuel economy at a time when it should be phased out for social and environmental reasons.
Jim Follett, any final thoughts on your part?
I think that we're at a
really crucial point in our democracy and how U.S. foreign policy is waged around the world. What we're seeing is a hijacking of U.S. foreign policy by corporations and by their philosophers, who in the 1990s decided that sanctions are an ineffective way to change regimes, particularly those regimes that don't do business with U.S. corporations. And so in think tank papers and in conferences, these guys out of office, while the Clinton administration was in office, formulated the present strategy in Iraq, and also and the subsequent strategy we're seeing enveloping places like Cuba and potentially Syria, places that are off limits to U.S. business. They prefer war to sanctions.
Jim Valad is co-author of the Institute for Policy Studies' recent report titled Crude Vision, How Oil Interests Obscured U.S. Government Focus on Chemical Weapons Use by Saddam Hussein. As the General Accounting Office begins an investigation of possible Bush administration favoritism in the awarding of the Bechtel contract, Valad says that several members of Congress are currently examining his group's findings. Mohammed Mohsen Zubadi declared himself mayor of Baghdad yesterday after receiving the support of Iraqi and Iraqi exile groups. Zubadi is a close associate of Ahmed Chalabi, the leader of the Iraqi National Congress, which has received hundreds of millions of dollars from the CIA. Many observers consider the choice of Zubadi to run Baghdad the latest sign that the American army is positioning the controversial Chalabi for a central role in governing a post-war Iraq. From Amman, Jordan, Aaron Glantz has more.
The U.S. military airlifted Ahmed Chalabi into Iraq a week and a half ago, giving him a head start in the leadership race in post-war Iraq. The New York Times reports today 230 members of Chalabi's private army are sharing a base with U.S. special forces in the northern Iraqi city of Mosul. The London Daily Telegraph reports young men are tearing through the streets of Nasiriyah in pickup trucks with assault rifles, chanting pro-Chalabi slogans, stealing cars at gunpoint, while American soldiers look on. All of this is bad news, according to Basal Burgan, a politically active businessman in neighboring Jordan.
Saddam went, and another Saddam came in. And this is the show.
Burgan notes that a military court in Jordan found Chalabi guilty of stealing $300 million from the state bank Petra in 1989. Chalabi was sentenced to 22 years in prison, but the U.S. government helped him flee the country.
Now, a thief like Chalabi, who embezzled $300 million, I would not trust him with my pussycat. I would not trust him with a bag of falafel. This guy is a thief, and a thief could do anything. Many thieves start, you know, their life as picking apples from supermarkets, and they grow. Eventually, they can kill to rob a big bank. So I'm not going to trust the guy.
But the American army continues to support Ahmed Chalabi, allowing the fugitive to set up shop this week in the sprawling Baghdad palace of Saddam's powerful son, Uday Hussein. Chalabi is critical of giving the United Nations any important role in post-war Iraq, saying the UN, quote, messed up Iraq to begin with. Instead, Chalabi prefers a process where the Bush administration works with its Iraqi supporters for the reconstruction of Iraq. Dr. Ibrahim Alush is a professor of economics at Jordan's Petra University.
There will be committees appointed by the forces of occupation. First, they will be American mainly and partly British. And then they will pick a few Iraqis who will operate on the behalf of the Americans. So we can say that the decision-making, whether directly or indirectly, will be in the hands of the U.S. administration.
Alush doesn't think this relationship will go on without a fight, though. He says that while Iraqis may not have fought for Saddam Hussein, they will fight to control their own destiny.
The Iraqi people are not going to accept an Anglo-American occupation. So whether Saddam is in power or not, there will be resistance. In the short run or the long run, that's the lesson we have learned in South Lebanon and in Palestine. After 53 years of occupation, the resistance doesn't look like it's going to go away, is that, you know, does it? So let's just say that the war isn't over yet, but it's gone to phase two.
The other major factions operating under the American umbrella are the Iran-backed Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, the Iraq National Accord, and the two Kurdish rebel armies that fought alongside America, the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan and the Kurdistan Democratic Party. All of these groups have checkered human rights histories, and Amnesty International specifically singled out the two Kurdish groups this week for criticism over alleged purges of Arabs in the areas they control in the north. Amnesty is calling on U.S. authorities not to cooperate with Iraqis with records of human rights violations, but given the brutality of Saddam's regime, there is almost no civil society inside Iraq. Lisa Ndegu has just returned from Iraq as part of a team of volunteers from the group Voices in the Wilderness. She says whatever tack the U.S. takes, democracy will be slow to develop in Iraq.
It's a multi-layered situation, and it's not that cut and dried. And I think we know it also in our own realities. I mean, if we're in the West, for example, and we look at like how election works. You can't have an election without huge amounts of money, and that goes into, for example, advertising for this or that or the other. You can't have, you know, democracy is something that is being bought in many, many ways. The American dream, I think everybody wants the American dream. I'm not sure that, like, we're all aware of the price of it.
The five groups backed by the Bush administration will meet again in Nasiriyah, April 25th. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Aaron Glantz in Amman, Jordan.
Two cultural advisors to the Bush administration have resigned in protest over the failure of U.S. troops to prevent the wholesale looting of priceless treasures from Baghdad's Antiquities Museum. Martin Sullivan, who chaired the President's Advisory Committee on Cultural Property for 8 years, and panel member Gary Vicon, said they resigned because the U.S. military had advance warning of the danger to Iraq's historical treasures. "We certainly know the value of oil, but we certainly don't know the value of historical artifacts," says Vicon, director of the Walters Art Gallery in Baltimore. Peace Watch caught up with Vicon today, and he says it's fair to say that the looting of the Iraqi museum amounts to one of the greatest cultural disasters in Middle Eastern history, and he expressed his reasons for resigning from the President's Advisory Committee on Cultural Property.
"I guess I sensed that we'd failed, and that failure was really symptomatic, as I said, of a priority that was so different from the one that drew me to the committee and the work of the committee,
which is
this wonderful preoccupation we have with respect for the physical remains of the cultured past."
Mm-hmm.
"And I felt as if the rug were pulled out from underneath me, and I just couldn't keep the two in my head at the same time, so I decided I wouldn't, and that's that."
Mm-hmm. When you say that we failed, you're referring to the Bush administration's failure to protect these ancient treasures and Iraqi artifacts?
Yeah, I mean, that's the point of failure. The point of failure is in leadership, planning, and execution, but I would say the failure is broader because this failure has lots of parents. And we have to hold accountable the folks that actually went into the museum, whether they were organized thieves, and I think they probably were, some of them, or just folks who were just crazed and were stealing anything that wasn't nailed down, whether it was a typewriter or a votive from Samaria. They are responsible because they're thieves. They're stealing something. No matter what their circumstance, they're stealing something.
And at
our other end, obviously, we as a culture have failed to educate ourselves to appreciate the past. I mean, that is just, it's a window on us, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, the power on the ground and the authority that directed it has to really look in the mirror and say, how did this happen? What should we have done?
Help us to sort of get a full appreciation of what the looters carried off. We know that there were 170,000 artifacts in that museum.
I've seen that number, and I would be surprised if all of that's gone. My guess is in the initial moments, just the anguish that was felt by those who devoted their lives to that museum probably gave it expression in very strong terms and high numbers. But All you have to do is look at the photographs of the cases that are broken and smashed and people running through the museum and translate that into any museum that you know and value in your own city. It's pretty easy to get a sense of how devastating that intervention was.
This particular museum, however, according to reports, was some 7,000 years of history dating
right.
back to the Mesopotamia?
Yes, and even it's Mesopotamia is the area, that which means between the rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates, and it's the culture that we call Mesopotamia, and actually has a whole bunch of units in it over a period of almost 3,000 years. But it is the cradle of civilization. That's the simplest way to define it. This
mm-hmm.
is where writing began. This is where thoughts among humans about what the divine was and what death meant and things like this, where commerce, the meeting of Africa, Asia, and Europe right at this spot. And everybody would tromp through it, and some would stick around for a while, and there are flavors of so many different peoples and so many small and some large empires that developed between roughly 3,000 B.C. and 500 B.C.
Mm. It's been reported that among the priceless treasures are the 5,000-year-old vase of Uruk, a gold harp.
The gold harp I can almost see in my mind's eye. And those wonderful bronze heads of the Sumerian king. Now, I have to hope that those were put someplace else, at least. Or perhaps whoever took them knows what they are and is going to take care of them in the hope of making some money.
Mm-hmm.
I hope they're not lost to us forever.
It was suggested that it's a possibility that some of them had been taken and placed on display in Saddam Hussein's many palaces.
Right, I've heard that. I wouldn't be surprised at all if he would do that. I'm not sure if I'm very encouraged by that, given that these were targets. And unlike the museums and the archaeological sites, which I think the United States really effectively put, from the bombing point of view, very much off limits. The bombers didn't show up, but neither did the troops.
Mm. And so you said earlier that there could have perhaps been organized thieves.
We read
reports where some of them seemed to have keys and
yes.
to know exactly where to go to get what.
And that doesn't surprise me. This is a moment of desperation. And the boundary between the desperate neighbor, the desperate inhabitants of that neighborhood who just is looking for subsistence, and perhaps an employee of the museum who knows where the keys are kept, perhaps somebody who was a Ba'ath Party official in the neighborhood who has a car, and they form bonds and act quickly and see opportunity, and pretty soon you're in the predicament we're in right now.
Mm. One article said there were artifacts in the museum that would require a crane to lift and remove them.
Right.
Yet these artifacts are no longer there that
right.
we know of. How could they have been removed without the soldiers themselves being aware of it?
Well, I'm not surprised at that. I don't think they were in the neighborhood to look. I read that they were briefly at the museum and briefly the looting stopped and they left and it started again. So if you've got 2 days, night and day, and you know where you're going, you have equipment, and you're motivated, there's a lot that can happen, and clearly a lot did happen.
Does your suspicion extend beyond just the Iraqi people in terms of the possibility of organized thieves? What about the possibility that professional thieves that may have been there ahead of this invasion specifically for the purpose of
this? I wonder about that. I think people who know this part of the world much better than I do suspect that there were non-Iraqi participants in this. What that really means is hard to say because the art smuggling world is boundaryless. They're very good at what they do. They're very motivated, and it's a series of connecting links from a $10 to a $1,000 to a $10,000 to a $800,000 transaction, all for the same object, depending on where you are and how close you are to the client. And these folks know what they're doing, like the drug trade. They're smart. They're motivated. They have lots of experience. They have great connections. And they live outside the law.
Mm.
So what that means in terms of people in that city, I have no idea. They still have to bank somehow on the moment when the city's going to collapse. So maybe they, you know, the Ba'ath Party officially says, well, maybe we're not going to come out of this so well. Let's see what I can do for myself in the chaos.
Now, there was a coalition of art lawyers and right. antiquities collectors.
I'm actually a member of that.
You're a member of that group. Right. And so you all met with the State Department officials.
The head of the group, our group did, yes.
What role was that coalition hoping to play in the aftermath of the invasion?
Well, not in the aftermath. Their goal before the fact was to alert the Department of Defense and the State Department of the critical points, both archaeologically and in terms of the museums, in order that they not be bombed and that in the aftermath they would be protected. And I gather that they got their point across, but in the chaos of events, as they unfolded, the plan was not executed such as there was a plan. Or if it was executed so poorly that it didn't have any effect.
So are you still a member of that coalition, or did resign that as well?
I have no quarrel with that.
Okay.
If I can kind of draw a distinction between the two, I am I was a special government employee as a member of the Cultural Property Advisory Committee.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, I was, in effect, an employee of the State Department. And I hold the State Department, the Defense Department, accountable for a failure in which we all participated. And that failure is something that leaves me kind of, I would say, almost spiritually exhausted in my quest, so that's why I resigned. The other group is one that exists totally outside of government, and its point is to establish and articulate policy and cultural property in order that we can arrive someday at a point where smuggling is a thing of the past, but legitimate collecting and vigorous and intelligent archaeology is what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, what were the plans for those Iraqi treasures? How do these things work? I mean, when a country plans to go in and invade another country, what are the plans for the treasures such as the ones that were lying in the museum? And I know there's a thing called the 1970 UNESCO Convention.
Well, yeah, that's the UNESCO Convention. There's the Hague Convention of 1954 on cultural property. The basic thrust of all of this is that it should be respected. Now, the United States, I'm sure, will say, and probably has already said in a variety of ways, yes, we respected it. We didn't bomb it. We didn't steal it. It wasn't our intention to take it away. That is not the issue. The issue is that in a position of authority and power, in a moment of chaos, responsibility has to at least be shared very significantly by that power source for events as they unfold, whether it's the destruction of a hospital or the slaughter of kids in a classroom by some crazy, or in this case, the looting of a major archaeological museum.
Mm. Well, some were concerned that by the ACCP meeting with the government, they were some scientists and archaeologists were alarmed, and they were fearful that the group that you belong to is working with a hidden agenda that will see the U.S. authorities ease restrictions on the movement of the Iraqi artifacts after the victory, the U.S. and British victory in Iraq.
No, not so.
No hidden agenda.
No. Their business, our business on that committee is policy.
Mm-hmm.
And the policy really is, in this case, to create within the Defense Department and the State Department an awareness, authority, and action steps to respond to a sense of value for the material of the past, as you respond to a sense of value for oil, as you certainly respond to a sense of value for life. You know, these are things that we care about, obviously life being at the top, but soon thereafter we need to be putting history and the things of history along with things like oil, which is the wherewithal to rebuild a country.
So will these artifacts be protected under some sort of, I don't know, the UNESCO Convention or other laws that are in place to protect these type of treasures?
Well, the UNESCO Convention is a multi-signator acknowledgement of a value, but provides no mechanism to act on that. And the United States was a very early signer, but it took another, 12 years before the United States had legislation that created the committee that I resigned from,
mm-hmm.
which was the committee that actually acted on that value.
So I guess what my question is really is, what will happen when these artifacts start to resurface? Will they just be products on the so-called black market?
I think so. Yes. You know, if you just look at it that simply, this stolen property, it's sort of, I suppose, like the drug trade. You know, there's lots of apparatus. There's a war on drugs. And by golly, there sure is a lot of drugs.
But if someone purchases through the black market this bootleg property, are they subject to any kind of international criminal laws?
They are. I mean, they'd be, in the United States, they'd be subject to the Stolen Property Act.
Which would carry what kind of penalties?
Same as if somebody received, bought a Mercedes from somebody who stole it from the neighbor. You cannot convey good title if you're a thief. So you are complicit in the transaction. And if you do it knowingly, if you do it at all, you're culpable. If you do it knowingly, you're very culpable. And if you're a purveyor, in other words, not simply a recipient, but you in turn pass it to a third party for money, then you are really, really in trouble. And a case is being has been prosecuted recently for an Egyptian antiquities dealer, and he's very likely going to jail.
Gary V. Kahn resigned his position as a cultural advisor to the Bush administration over its failure to protect some 7,000 years of Iraqi artifacts looted from the Iraqi Museum after the U.S.-led invasion. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.